Well, being we're starting now.
I just need a piece of paper.
Yes.
Do I have a piece? That's great.
Yes.
Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Yeah, Nicolette's just getting some paper for those of you not watching the live show here. So we're finishing last week's lecture, topic 9. There is no new material after that. We're just going to do a review if we have time. A couple of other things I wanted to talk about, which I haven't yet, like the assignment. But we'll wait and see if anyone wants to do it. If no one wants to do it, then I don't have to worry about setting it. And that's not to dissuade anyone from doing it. But I think Anthony was indicating at the beginning of the course that he might like to do an essay, so I'll wait till he comes before talking about that. But I don't know who's just talking about that. I don't know if anyone's up to date on how things are running at FUB, because I heard from Matt in a meeting, which I only attended very briefly, that people are writing dissertations at the end of their degree or free degree. Have you heard anything about that, Alex or Maria or James?
I heard the same thing, that you could sort of get by on attendance.
Yeah.
If you didn't write any essays, but there's a dissertation to write at the end of the course.
Yes.
In the end of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Well, all the courses you do.
Yeah.
I think so. You only have to do one dissertation, I think.
On a particular course. Or?
Particular subject, you choose what you write on, and then you get aligned a tutor to work to mark for you.
Yes, but that you can, I don't know how it works. Whether you can do essays and then not need to do a dissertation, or whether the essays are just optional now. I think they're very useful.
Hi,
Margarita, Michael. I'm just talking about the assignment, but I think I'll wait until later to go into details about it.
Yeah.
So last week we were, I think we got to slide 3, unfortunately, but that's because I was finishing the week before. So this week we've got to finish.
We're having lights on.
You want to turn the lights off, me?
I don't know.
I'm happy to. Yeah. Oh well, I'm the boss. Turn them off and let's look at this. Turn them off, Nick.
I'll go with what other people feel. Like.
Well, no, Alex voting for a light. I'm voting for. I turn off the light. Turn off the light. Turn off the light. There, you see there, daylight, everyone, except for the screen. Pupils will adjust. You're the pupils. Sorry, it's a pun. Pupils. Yes. Yes. There's not many jokes, anymore. I was only reviewing that. How in my early teaching days, I used to crack jokes all the time. You know, it was like I was doing a stand-up comedy routine. But somehow, ages made me more serious. So the synthesis of intersubjectivity. I was inclined to. Skip over this because we've already spoken about how we constitute the world together. That's essentially what the synthesis of intersubjectivity is about. The world becomes, we're looking at the meaning of the world, and there's a certain level, right, we have to get back into phenomenology again, where it appears to us that it's all already been done. And phenomenology is a looking back into, yes, but what is the structure of the meaning of the world and how is it constituted? And Husserl particularly comes from the place of saying, well, to begin with, and we're going to look at this more in this lecture, there's just my solipsistic self. Hi, Lenka. We know the words. Is everyone familiar with solipsism? Yes?
I sort of forget.
So,
I am an
African. Solipsism is a kind of view of that takes it to be the case that only I am conscious, and that it's a kind of a, it's like taking Descartes very, very seriously. If you take Descartes very, very seriously, you doubt everything that can be doubted, then you can doubt that other people are conscious. And there are, it's very hard to hold a solipsistic view consistently, because you wouldn't, why would you be telling a lot of unconscious people that you're a solipsist? arguing, how dare you say I'm not a solipsist, you know, I'm going to convince you I am. So if you are a solipsist, then I guess the best, if you really truly hold to it, you don't really have anything to say to it, except it, maybe it's like amusing, like playing a computer at chess or something, yeah. But so solipsism is the view that all that's real is consciousness. And if we take that very, very seriously, then all that's real is my consciousness, and you are all of the people around me and the life, the animals, just appearances with no inherent consciousness in those appearances. How can I know that? Well, I can't know that, but I'm taking a position where I'm sticking with what I'm certain of. And if you stick with what you're certain of, then you're utterly alone in this experience of consciousness.
Very, very,
you
feel very lonely.
Yeah, I mean, there's this distinction between the word lonely and alone. Lonely is when your aloneness causes you suffering.
Yes.
But aloneness, there's a quality of aloneness that can have a certain profundity in it, which doesn't have any loneliness in it. But I'm digressing already. Yes, I'm digressing already. Yes. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about the synthesis of intersubjectivity, and this that we live. If you like, if we consider the world as a meaning construct, the meaning of the world for us is, it's not solipsistic. We experience the world as our world. That this space that is here over the table is not, I don't experience it as something that's happening in my consciousness. Even if I grant you consciousness, I don't think, oh yes, this is my private experience of the room, and you're having your private experience of the room. A philosopher can think that way, but we don't live that way. Phenomenology is saying, well, how do we actually experience this room? And there's a sheer meaning here present to us, that this is the same space for all of us. And we're here together, and it's the one and the same world for all of us. And Husserl recognises that a certain synthesis has gone on there, because there is a level where it is actually, if you look at the brain again, if you take a scientific view, then solipsism does start to look quite convincing, because in effect what I am experiencing is something that's just happening in the cells of my brain. Of course, I would argue with that, but from a purely scientific point of view, you'd say, oh yeah, actually you are having a private experience of all of those neurons firing in the brain. And if you don't believe me, then here's the neurosurgeon. He's going to do some experiments on your brain, and then at the end of that you'll be saying, yes, you were right. My brain is actually what's producing this experience. If you look at it that way, you would say, "Ah, yes, I'm having a private experience of the neurons that are firing in my brain, and everyone else is too. And there isn't really a common world out here. That's a kind of a meaning that we place on it." Now, I spend a lot of time, in effect, working on the side of natural perception. See, natural perception is actually telling us the truth, as far as I'm concerned. It's true we're all here in the room together, and it's true that this space that's in front of us is a common space. If you forget about the brain, it's true because I can reach over and I can touch you, and you feel it. That's proof, isn't it? That we there's something about doing philosophy, where you if you start thinking about things, you can become entirely lost to the reality of the actual living life that that you inhabit, but you become lost in a world of thought, because there's a certain level where your body, your system, your natural intelligence, if you like, just carries on. Never doubted that the world was here, never doubted that, that other people were here. It's quite a, you need to be going to quite an artificial mental space to be able to doubt all of that. But a lot of what we might call traditional philosophy, academic philosophy, people do inhabit that artificial space and enjoy inhabiting it and enjoy playing, if you like, what if kind of I call them games, really. This is another talk about phenomenology, in a way. Phenomenology isn't about playing such games. It's about studying experience as we find it. And experience as we find it, we find that we are in this world together. And Husserl's, particularly in this lecture, he's looking at, well, how is that? How does that come about? What lies behind that? How is that achieved? How is that meaning construct, if you like, achieved? How do we arrive at this idea of a world for all, instead of a world that's just for me? And it's at every level, Husserl is looking at how things are synthesized together, which means things that are separate are brought into a unity that you experience as a unity, like the separateness of all of our experiences are brought into a unity in our understanding of what the world is. Now I'm just going to skip that slide and jump to the main work of the day, the infatuation of the ego. Yes, what's the ego infatuated with? The world, the things of the world. So I'll have a little read now. The natural objective world life is a particular mode of the transcendental life which forever constitutes the world. Now, I may have been asleep, and indeed I probably did miss this, but it's I have the sense that this is the first time that I've heard Husserl say transcendental life in the crisis. He may have said it before, but this is the first time I've woken up and said, transcendental life. That's an interesting... You see, transcendental subjectivity seems to point to you're being a kind of a transcendental ego with your transcendental subjectivity, me being a transcendental ego with my transcendental subjectivity. There's a sense of separation in it that the constituting power, if you like, is in each one of us. But the word transcendental life indicates that it's an impersonal, something impersonal, something not personal is constituting experience. Because we're in a lot of what this lecture is about this question hovering in the background. So we're able to recognize, you know, right back to how our experience is being constituted, but we've never really opened up, well, what's the agency? Who's doing the constituting? Husserl's answer has always been transcendental subjectivity. In a way, the question is, well, what or who is that? It's a good final lecture, isn't it? Because in a way, you see, we've been looking at the way that things are constituted with a kind of an assumption that something is doing it. And in a way, this lecture is, well, who is doing it, but not speculatively. And if we're phenomenologists, is there some way that we can work back toward who is doing it, or what is doing it, or is who or what, are they wrong words to describe this? So this is just setting the background, and that pings off transcendental life, because another thing to understand about Husserl is it looks like a piece of finished work, right? The crisis, like, and he's near the end of his life, but it's not. See, for him, phenomenology is an exploration of that only goes so far. So he was in his life, in his phenomenological investigations, he only got so far. He only clarified so much, and he really regarded it as a kind of an infinite task that he left behind for we philosophers to continue. So when you're, I think what we're dealing with here, when we're looking back into transcendental subjectivity, we're looking into something that Husserl himself never really clarified. You know, he's left, you know, it's hard to say that he's wrong about anything, because it's phenomenology, if you see what I mean, isn't a kind of a thing where you're wrong, but it's a thing where you may not have seen as far as you could. There can be, you can go deeper, and when you go deeper, you look back on where you were before and you say, I hadn't fully understood things. Do you know, it's not like a process where people say, I'm right, you're right. No, I'm wrong, you're wrong. You don't argue about it. It's a matter of finding a way into the phenomenon. If you can find a way into the phenomenon, that's how it progresses. And it's not a matter of argument, it's a matter of insight. I wonder if in your other philosophical studies, if you see the distinction about the process of what phenomenology is about. It's an entirely different process, let's say, to what we would regard as Anglo-American analytic philosophy, which is much more a disputatious. Intellectual kind of philosophy. You read Husserl and you say, well, what isn't that intellectual? But it, at the heart of it, you see, it's not.
Isn't an argument to dispute
it. Yes, he's not presenting an argument. Yeah. He's saying, this is what I've seen. This is what I've seen. Maybe I haven't seen clearly. If you can see more clearly than I, then I would, that would be a gift for you to show me, not something that would cause us to argue. But that's the kind of ideal of phenomenology, because in the end, of course, Heidegger and Husserl did argue, or if they didn't argue directly, they argued indirectly with each other, because they didn't argue, if you like, about the phenomenological seeing, they argued about the understanding of being that lay at the very root of what Husserl was I think you'll find that this is my experience. It's impossible to understand anything without some kind of framework that precedes that understanding. And a lot of transcendental philosophy is an investigation into that framework. But there's a kind of idea or ideal in there that I think Husserl had at the beginning, that in the end you can see right through it, that you'd be absolutely free of the framework of which is a kind of a certain understanding of being, of how things are, that you could delve back into there and end up in a place where you have no framework, as if you could have some kind of ultimate, total, complete knowledge of what is. And maybe one way that Husserl and Heidegger differed was that Heidegger didn't accept that, and modern philosophy hasn't accepted that. And there's a, you would say now, even in phenomenology, I think there's a broad agreement that you're always going to come from a certain understanding. The best you can hope to do is to recognise that rather than be utterly unconscious of it, if you see what I mean. I'm influenced by David Bohm here, the physicist. There's a certain... he had a certain understanding of the universe that in whatever way that you perceive it, you unfold it into a certain kind of experience. And the unfolding into an experience is always partial. And there are many ways that you can unfold an experience of what is, and human perception is one of them. But to think that you could have a perception of the totality of what is to misunderstand the structure, that all experience is an enfolding, a partial unfolding of something that you can't experience in its totality as anything explicit. You take a certain dimensionality, if you like, in your perception of the universe that is part of your perception, not part of the universe. And in a way, what is the what is being unfolded in experience is we always want to picture it. Do you see? And it's what can't be pictured. I think we've reached. Isn't this everyone? Everyone who's like, oh yes, reckon. Still yes, because we're going to run out of room around the table in a minute.
Well, because I've overtaken three chairs.
So I'm circling around it. I'm doing my usual introduction in a way. I'm circling around the fact that as we start to look back into transcendental subjectivity, we're starting to look back into the source. That's the best word I can give for it. And in a way, there's a kind of a questioning in that looking back into the source, that sort of seeking some kind of complete and total understanding of what it is that lies behind, or is from whence does experience come? And we're asking that question. And I'm already sort of saying, well, any idea we have of it is going to be partial. And I'm not, in a way, I'm not in a position to prove that. And most of us, most of the time, don't really see that. I'm working on this in my book at the moment, because we've got a certain kind of scientific understanding of experience that says this about experience. It says, what do you mean that your experience of the universe is a kind of something that you can't conceive, that's a kind of some kind of ultimate mystery, that's all nonsense according to Western science, because Western science says, well, what you're perceiving is the usual old stuff, electromagnetic radiation. It's all the stuff that we've discovered scientifically. If you look into what you're perceiving, you're perceiving photons hitting your retina. Your perception comes from the molecules of the air vibrating, and it all comes for it's all reduced down and made into an experience by the firing of the neurons in the brain. Now that is an example of an understanding that has attempted to encapsulate the totality and say there's nothing, that's it, that's the totality, there's nothing, we've got it, our arms are entirely around it. This is what objective science implicitly says. There's no mystery, it says. In fact, there are people in that domain who think it's their job to get rid of mystery. That's the task of science, to say, well, if there's a mystery, that's just the forefront of science. That's the next thing we're going to get rid of for you, because finally we want to encompass everything within the structure of this explanation that we have. And our civilization is more or less caught in that idea. Not as individuals, we all can have our own ideas about what's going on, but as a civilization, we're caught up in that idea of a kind of that our rational scientific understanding encompasses everything. And it doesn't. You see, what science is projecting a certain understanding of matter, and saying that that understanding of matter is what is. And the thing that we, those of us studying philosophy of consciousness, have to continuously, you have to slap yourself around the face and say, but I'm conscious. There's consciousness here. That entire scientific explanation with all of its electromagnetic fields, all of its atoms and molecules, all its quantum mechanics, has nothing to say about my being conscious, has nothing to say about the form of my experience, has nothing to say about the origins of space and time, has nothing to say about what colour is.
And it doesn't show in the microscope, it doesn't show.
No, no. It's entirely an explanation of what can be observed physically. And it's an attempt to encompass everything by... you see, the understanding of being that lies behind that is that being is physical. And the thing is, as soon as you accept that, then everything else follows from it. And it's almost like you get... I'm particularly vulnerable to this, because it's almost like being a Catholic. Instead of... sorry if you are a Catholic, but it's... they used to say, give me a child until they're seven and I've got him for life. This is, in a way, materialistic science got me when I was a little child. It's a grippingly real thing for me, because it was put into me at a very early age. So I find I can slip into that and say, it is all photons, atoms and molecules. Of course it is. There's nothing else. That's why I have to hit myself, slap myself with the wet fish from Monty Python. Say, no, but wake up, John. Remember, this consciousness is here. There's a whole... That is just a partial view of the universe. But the next idea is, of course, and philosophy does is, all right, well, we'll just add consciousness in. Then we'll have the total picture. And I guess what I'm saying in this introduction is, if you truly understand that all experience has to take what is and place it in a certain form in order for it to be an experience, it can never actually show you or express to you or make perceivable to you what is before it's been experienced. we were, John and I were actually talking about this. It's because we make, in our perception, we make being. We make things be. And if you want to try and think about what lies before that is what things are before they are. Before they get the being that we give them by experiencing them. Schopenhauer was the probably the first Western philosopher to really grasp this. He took Kant, and Kant's insight that space and time are forms of our experience. They're things that we bring in order to make experience intelligible. But Kant still thought that there were things in themselves, if you like, behind our experience. And Schopenhauer was to the first Westerner, if you like, to say, well, if space and time are forms of our experience, then what lies behind of experience can't be in space and time. And that's, that begins to give you an idea of what is. If what is isn't in space and time, Schopenhauer called it the principium individualis, or I don't speak Latin, but something like that. The principle of individuation. It's only by means of space and time that things become individuated. If we take that away, then what is no longer separable in itself. It's experience that separates one thing from another that makes things. Are you getting a sense for what might lie behind experience, and why you'd have to say you can't think of it? You can't intelligibly think of it, because it's what you think of is what is you giving form to it. Form according to the framework within which you think. So this is a long circle all the way back to say the idea, which is kind of right at the heart of our science, that you could possibly come to a total understanding of what is, has an ignorance in it. As soon as you start looking back into experience and what experience is, and you start to see the if you like, the work that's done to make the world an intelligibly manifested experience, it should be starting to dawn on you that you can get back so far in that dome of experience, looking into how it's structured and how it's appeared, but only so far. I feel like saying, and thank God. You know, who's God? Well, God's, I put it to you, if you like, without being religious, a name for what lies behind experience. I mean, we're not saying Christian, we're not saying no denomination, nothing. It's a good word for that. If you can withdraw all of the, you know, what man's done. And what man's religion has done, God's a good word for it. But it took me a long time in my life to actually be able to use the word God, because it's been a kind of I associate it with a kind of human ignorance.
Yeah.
The totality of the sorry.
No, I was just saying, if we make the idea of God into our own image, rather than the other way round, God making us in His image. So.
Yes, yes, because if it hadn't, in a way, it's a sad thing, because it's the word we have for that. But it's the best word we have for that. But we've kind of ruined it along with all the other power words, you know, like love, you know. There are certain words that have that are meant to have a transcendental meaning. You know, they're meant to point straight through the the surface of experience and refer to something that's transcendental. And they've all been, you know, they've all been, in a sense, had their power taken away from them by being misused. But they still, if you can get back far enough, they still refer, they can still work. But in a way, you know, there's, you have to create a space in which you can start to use them again. You know, you can't really use them in the public domain. You know, it's no good. Well, you can if you're an American politician. I mean, Barry, God's impeaching Donald Trump. I was seeing on the news. But of course, on Trump's side, you know, God's on. Anyway, that's another story, isn't it? And that all came out of the one word, two words, transcendental life.
The totality of the noumenon.
Yes. 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 I think if that's not Rekha, we might shut the door. Yeah. Just to avoid. That's right. We'll never get through this slide otherwise. So, the natural objective world life is a particular mode of the transcendental life which forever constitutes the world. I don't know, I mean, at this point in the class, I almost find that poetic. But in such a way that transcendental subjectivity, while living on in this mode, has not become conscious of the constituting horizons and never can become aware of them, in so long as it's in what we call the natural attitude. This is Husserl saying, before the epoch came. It lives in infatuation, so to speak, with the poles of unity, the object poles that if you like, you know, lie behind the surface of experience, the object pole of the phone. It's the phone that's getting the treatment today, not the cup. Without being aware, this is the poles of unity, of the constituting multiplicities belonging essentially to them. How it is that our idea of the phone is constituted out of all the multiplicities of ways that it can show itself to us. For this would require a complete reorientation and reflection, namely the epoche. It arises originally out of the needs of human praxis, which you could say catching rabbits. Have I missed a bit?
Objective truth.
Objective truth.
Yeah.
Belongs exclusively within the attitude of the natural human world life. So, and again, I feel like, you know, I just mentioned this about science. So our natural human world life is concerned with the objects and the object poles, because we're concerned with getting about in the world, with not injuring ourselves, with surviving, with getting food, with having children. Husserl's talking about this infatuation with the world is the infatuation of our natural egoic selves. There's something here as well that is, whether we're phenomenologists or not, as soon as we do something, as soon as we kind of become engaged in something that requires our attention, we naturally fall into that mode anyway. I don't think Husserl ever intended here to suggest that we should be in an epoche all day long. Do you know you can't hold that state of consciousness when you become very involved in doing something, when it requires your full attention, and rightly so. And similarly, you can't hold the epoche if you get very involved in thinking.
And also, I was thinking about the gender as such, and not mental abilities, but practicality between males and females, especially once there are children involved. You put it on the side, yeah, it's all good, but practicality comes first.
Yes. And I think it as soon as something like a fire alarm happens, and then there's smoke, and then there's flames, you know, I think the Apple case soon slips away. it's where, how do I get out? Although it's a strange, I mean, I remember that, but my one car accident, wasn't too serious, but it was quite serious. I was in a VW bus, and I dropped a cigarette. I thought, oh God, and it wasn't my bus, so I thought, I'm going to burn the carpet, you know. So I went down to pick the cigarette up and drove it into the back of a parked car. It should have stopped and picked the cigarette up, by the way, if you want any advice, not attempt that while driving. And there I was, right, and you know, what a old VW buses, there's no engine, there's just a bit of tin. And you know, my knees kind of crushed up against the seat, and I'm on the floor, you know, and everything's, you know, it's a bit of a shock. I didn't even see what happened, you know, and I finally climb out of it, and I get out of it, and there's all these people, you know, come out of their houses. My God, what's happened? And I'm just there. If you like, I'm in an apple cave. The stars. What a beautiful evening. You never know when something like that is going to come over you, you know, because all the consequences, you know, it's not my vehicle, you know, how am I going to get it out of here, I need a tow truck, all of that, nothing, just what, look at the stars, it's such a beautiful night, you know. But I mean, I think basically I'm somewhere, something in me said, you survived, John, you're still here. It wasn't so bad. Yeah, that's another digression that says it's not quite so simple as all of that. You know, we have an idea that if we were caught up in a world of survival, that we'd be entirely concerned with our practical lives. Whereas I think when you're involved in danger and survival, there's more of the transcendental too. You know, they go together. I mean, I never had to fight in a war, but I think there would have been an element of that in facing death.
It's very well presented in the War and Peace.
Yes.
Campbell comes here. And
yes. Oh yeah. Of course. Yeah. Of course. Yeah. On the battlefield,
that's
as well,
right.
Looking up,
that's
and
right.
seeing the sky. Mm. That's right. I had one of those moments with the VW. Fortunately, I didn't have to go. I didn't have to go to war with Napoleon in order to experience it.
Do you think that's what Gurdjieff was pushing at all the time when he was experimenting with people and groups and making them do the most strenuous sort of exercises? Pushing people through, like the one where he had his group digging out a canal, and then the water started to come in. And he told them not to stop, whatever happened, don't stop. And then, of course, the water starts coming into the canal, and some people think, ah, he doesn't know, it's up to my knees, I'm getting out. And then it gets up to their chests, and everybody else is out except one person. And then Gurdjieff dives in and gets the last person, and he says, you're the only one that understood, because he was going into that VW moment of surrendering. Because the sort of Eastern excuse for all this of not knowing, I don't want to go into a big divergence, but they say you can't know it with the mind. So that sounds like a very good excuse, but it also could be true, because you don't get it until you've given up your mind, and then you suddenly have a flash.
Yes.
And it's shock also.
Yes, yes. There's something about.
You get shocked.
There's something about
being now.
I guess with. Like with Zen Buddhism and the cone, and when there's a kind of an intent in it, it's different to when, if you like, life just crashes yes. the VW. You know, you feel like again, you feel like God did that. You know, not. It's got that other. Not that I was thinking God did it, but in the way we're speaking now, you'd say, well, there. You see, if we can get out of our physical cause and effect understanding of what's behind events, then there's room for your events to be meaningful again. Like that moment with the bus. Where are we? Yes. So the objective truth. Yes, I was just going to say that you see, science, our objective science, is a kind of an attempt to utterly perfect that infatuation of the ego with the objects. So objective science just wants to take that and take it as far as you possibly can, down the microscope, down the telescope, searching for the structure, the final true objective structure of the things around us. And science is just taken what's in that natural attitude and taken it as far as it can possibly be taken. But that's why it's so compelling as well, because it isn't just some artificial thing that somebody thought up. It's a kind of an extension of something that's in us naturally, and we've extended it technologically. Our technology is extending our perception, our perceptual abilities, and yet it's extended them into a realm where the entities that we are talking about, we actually are no longer perceptually present to us. So we get lost in another way in science. You know, we don't meet quarks, do we? Or electrons or photons. But now we have an idea that they are the ultimate, truly real things. So something about science, it started off wanting to perfect our perceptual powers over the Earth to give us more control over events. But it's in the development of its instruments, it's now shot us past, if you like, the perceptual surface of things, and now our scientific understanding of things, our perceptual world and the scientific model have become separated. Again, this is part of our, what's the word I want to use there? I can't get the word, but it's part of the situation that we're in now. Let's get back and finish this. So, it arises out of the needs of human praxis as the intent to secure what is straightforwardly given as existing, the object pole anticipated in ontic certainty as persisting. That's what existing means. Against the possible modalizations of certainty. So yes, the impulse is to secure that securing is being sure of what actually exists. Securing it against the modalizations of certainty, being sure that we're not perceiving something that's illusory, or only probably so. Again, he's almost describing a kind of a human impulse to make everything predictable, which, you know, I think we've been talking about this, which is how now neuroscience is understanding what the brain, what the neocortex anyway, that's what it's trying to do. You can sort of see science as a kind of as an outgrowth of the neocortex. It's interesting, of course, because the neocortex is still only the surface of the brain. It's not the whole brain. And the recently grown surface. So one of the things that becomes apparent is I was talking before about how the neocortex, the regions of the neocortex, form a hierarchy of connections. You know, this area is connected to this area, such that information coming from the senses goes up to this area, but this area here doesn't get any direct information from the senses. It gets its information about what's going on from a lower area, and it sends feedback to that area about what it's expecting, and then there's another area up here that's getting information about what's going on in this, from the senses, from this area, but not from the lower area. So it's even one remove from the senses. And again, it's sending feedback, but only to the area below it, that then sends feedback to the area below that. And as the neocortex, which all mammals have, starts to grow, then that's what happened with the human brain, you start getting extra capacity. You know, you only need a certain amount of neocortex to do your basic prediction of what's happening now. I think what happens in the human brain is that its extra capacity is able to start to predict what's going to happen in a place that isn't now. You know, we've got enough capacity to imagine another now. And if you like, you could sort of say the whole problem of the human race is what we've done with that extra capacity. You know, we've done science out of it, we've made religion out of it, we've done a whole lot of stuff, but really, essentially, what we've got is extra capacity in the hierarchy. You know, the hierarchy got so far, and there's more brain. So I can imagine my hunting expedition. I mean, I don't want to digress too far on that, because that's the next course. Because the only way that extra capacity is able to function is if you have language. Language is the key to, if you like, being able to separate yourself from now. It's a kind of do you know, like it's like a mythical gift. It gives you terrible power, and the other side of it is, but you could become completely lost in that power that's been granted you. You can become completely lost in the world of the upper level of the hierarchy in such a way that you, I mean, this is our culture. You start to lose connection with the senses. Or, you know, you're mildly in touch. You don't get run over on the way home.
It's a natural growth of neocortex.
Yes.
It's a growth, it's a creation.
Yes.
If there are rocks, there are mountains, and there is the neocortex.
You know, this is philosophy class. You weren't looking for another class.
Well, not now, no.
You're not looking for the other class now.
I'd be very philosophical, as there is no other class.
Oh, there is. Oh, there is no other class.
It seems a bit peculiar that there are things that are written on the.
Yeah, there is another class there.
Yeah, there have been other people here. Where have they gone?
It's the mind theory of mind, the other class.
But there's nothing up. There's nothing actually in here, although I know there is asbestos that's meant to be in the main building. So perhaps they've decided to put it elsewhere. I'm sorry that I'm interrupting you, because I'm stopping you from the flow of things. Is this the first lesson, or have I arrived?
This is the last.
This is not the philosophy of mind.
No, I'm not. Is it okay if I sit here if there is no other class?
Yeah, it's okay.
Yeah?
Yep.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Cheers. But bear in mind, this is the final class.
Yeah, no, that's always interesting in itself. I've found you all.
Yes. So, let me finish the slide. I better finish this slide. In the reorientation of the epoché, nothing is lost. None of the interests and ends of world life, and thus also none of the ends of knowledge. But for all these things, their essential subjective correlates are exhibited, and thus the full and true ontic meaning of objective being, and thus of all objective truth, is set forth. Philosophy as a universal objective science, and this is what all philosophy of the ancient tradition was, together with all the objective sciences, is not universal science at all. It brings into its sphere of inquiry only the constituted object poles, and remains blind to the full concrete being and life that constitutes them transcendentally. It's at this, again, we're at this point of the course where I'm reading that out, and I have the sincere wish that that makes sense to you without me having to say very much about it. Because in a way you have to grasp this intuitively. The entire philosophy that was pre-transcendental was a philosophy that is only concerned with the objectivity of the objective world, and hadn't even recognized that the objective world is something that is being constituted in consciousness. So, you know, this is Husserl's message for the whole, is this whole book, if you like, is to say that, you know, the crisis of European sciences, if you like. The crisis of European sciences is that they're entirely focused on the constituted objective world, and that, if you like, the entire transcendental life that lies behind it is just not seen. So it can't be a universal science. But it's the sort of tragedy for us is that it takes itself to be a universal science. Not only does it not investigate the transcendental source of experience, it denies it. And as a culture, we remain enthralled to that view. And you might say, well, haven't all cultures? But in a way, any culture with a living religion has some kind of contact with the idea of there being a transcendental source. Not in the sense that Husserl means it, but in the sense that such a culture would never accept that it's all explicable in terms of mathematical physics. That's we're the first culture that's actually come to think that way. So, the paradox. Let's see if I can just read this slide and then explain it at the end instead of getting lost in the middle. Universal intersubjectivity, into which all objectivity, everything that exists at all, is resolved. I've got to stop there and say yes. So that, because it's objectivity only appears in the intersubjective world. The objects are objects that are the same for everyone. That's what being objective means. See, objectivity and intersubjectivity, you've got to see that they're completely linked. Because otherwise, you take the others away, then it's utterly, you're having an utterly subjective experience. You bring the others in, and suddenly it's not my personal experience of the phone. It's we're all experiencing the phone. So intersubjectivity creates objectivity, if you think of it phenomenologically. You know, the synthesis of intersubjectivity creates the idea of an objective world. But universal intersubjectivity can obviously be nothing other than mankind, which we might, you know, retranslate as humanity now. And the latter is undeniably a component part of the world. How can a component part of the world, its human subjectivity, constitute the whole world as its intentional formation, while the latter, the subjects accomplishing in cooperation, are themselves only a partial formation within the total accomplishment? The subjective part of the world swallows up, so to speak, the whole world and thus itself too. This is a paradox that the rest of the lecture is really about, and the end of the book. So you get the idea? We've got this idea that each of us as individuals, in some way or other, are constituting the world. And yet, the idea that we are individuals at all only makes sense within the being of a world. Think back to Schopenhauer. It's consciousness that constitutes the idea of there being individuals in the first place. And yet here we are saying that there's a whole bunch of individuals together are constituting the world. But how can there be individuals? What comes first? How are we to put this together? Do you get the sense of the paradox? That if we're all sitting out here and we're all in our way, we have our consciousness, but our consciousness is actually constituting the world. Oh, all well and good. If there was only me alone, that would kind of make sense. I'm just having a kind of a dream. But within the dream, I've come to understand that it's not a dream, because there are all these others here who share the dream. We're constituting the same world together. But we only appear here in the world, don't we? So how could something appearing in the world constitute the world? It can't work. We can't make sense of it. And I suggest we can't make sense of it anyway. You know, it's not as if we're going to, at the end of the day, make sense of it. But we're going to. Husserl is his approach, right? He's a phenomenologist. He's going to say, well, let's look into this, because everything that we experience is a certain structure of meaning. And if we look into the structure of the meaning, we'll find that there are layers of constitution that lie behind it. So we have to look again into how things stand within the epoche, and see if we can work something out here, work out an understanding that isn't a paradox. Right, back to reading. What an absurdity! If this paradox were insoluble, it would mean that an actually universal and radical epoche could not be carried out at all. If the disinterestedness of the epoche were merely those of the psychologist, then anything that is really tenable about our insights would be reduced to objective psychological essential insights, though of a new style. But can we be satisfied simply with the notion that human beings are subjects for the world which for consciousness is their world, and at the same time are objects in this world? And he's going to say, this is how we made sense of it before. As scientists, can we content ourselves with the view that God created the world and human beings within it, that he endowed the latter with consciousness and reason, that is, with the capacity for knowledge, the highest instance of which is scientific knowledge? Because if we go back to the scientific revolution, where all of this thinking originated, this paradox wasn't a paradox, because it was all arranged by God. God created the world, the physical world, and he gave us all consciousness. And he sort of stands. I'll use the word he, because he was a male demiurge in those days. He kind of arranges it and coordinates it all. He's kind of in charge of making sure that, that all of our experiences coincide. And in a way, what we do is we just put our faith in God. And what phenomenology has to say and what philosophy has to say is, well, I can't do that. That's not as a philosopher what I don't just believe in God through the revelation of the scriptures. I'm a Gnostic. I'm not going to accept anything unless I can have it shown to me or demonstrated to me. So the phenomenologist's approach is to say, well, no, my approach is to look into my own experience and see if I can see the source of this paradox, rather than handing it over and saying it's a tremendous paradox. How could it possibly be that it's all coordinated together? I hand it to God, and God fixes it up for me. And this was, you know, for instance, Leibniz, his view of the divine harmony. He described it as a divine harmony. It just happens that the way things are in the physical world is the way things play out in consciousness, and God takes care of it. And he's saying, well, as scientists, can we be satisfied with that? Because this, at the back of it, if you remember at the beginning of the course, we were looking into this teleos of what European civilization, going back to the Greeks, what its impulse was. And its impulse was this impulse. It was, I would call it, a Gnostic impulse. It was an impulse for direct knowledge. It was in a way, if you like, the pure impulse of the West. I think the pure impulse of the West was to say, I will accept nothing except insofar as it can be demonstrated to me in my immediate experience. And that's my understanding of the pure impulse behind science. You know, science may have got, you know, become this materialistic, what could I use the word, abomination? I don't know, that's a bit of a strong word. But there's a Gnostic impulse behind it, you know, and this Gnostic impulse was there in the early days of Christianity, before everybody was put to death. But I digress a long way into history there. How far did I get?
The end.
Did I get to the end?
Yes.
I did get to the end.
Yes.
Gosh. Gosh, I got to the end. Of course, because we're talking about God. Yes, you feel I might have dealt with that.
Yes.
Yeah. So who are we? So we're starting this regressive inquiry into our own experience to try and understand the source of this paradox and whether it can be resolved. Who are we as subjects performing the meaning and validity accomplishment of universal constitution? As those who in community constitute the world as a system of poles, as the intentional structure of community life. Can we mean we human beings in the natural objective sense, i.e. as real entities in the world, are the transcendental subjects, i.e. those functioning in the constitution of the world, human beings? After all, the epoche has made them into phenomena. Right, just reminding you that the epoche has suspended all acceptance one way or the other that there is any independent being beyond my immediate experience. So what we've got is my field of experience and the structures of meaning within that field of experience, and we're investigating those meaning structures, but we're saying that what things are, is they are phenomena. In that.
Sorry.
John Pickering.
No.
Do we?
This is. I waiting for the diagnosis of the person for the class that taking about the mind.
Yes, that's not this class.
No.
Do we know where any of these people are?
Theory of mind, it says today, but
no.
There's no sign of any.
I tried the only other group, because there was a big building.
It's supposed to be here.
Yes.
Yeah, but he's not here.
Yes,
but the other is here.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, it's not John Pickering. No. What was I saying? Does anybody remember? It's always a good
relative accomplishment of the universal constitution.
But was
that
we're
all here?
Yes. Is that completely
in
lost?
Are we real human beings?
Yes, I was talking about the epoche. I was just reminding us about the epoche and this suspension that's turned everything into a phenomenon. Yes, so our idea that that there are human beings here, objective human beings, we along with the phone, all of the individuals have become phenomena that we're studying, and we're interested in how. I have come to mean you to be, or intend you to be, another being like me. You're a phenomenon like that, to be understood in that way. The idea that you're that there's some kind of physical body that stands somehow behind my experience or outside of my immediate consciousness, we're saying, well, we're not saying one way or the other. And we're not, as far as the epoche is concerned, we forbid ourselves to refer beyond experience. One of the things that you end up with phenomenology is you forbid yourself to do that, and then you find that you can explain everything within the phenomena of experience. You don't need to go beyond it, and in fact, you can't. Your idea that there's anything beyond experience is an opinion. Nothing, something you could never possibly verify. There isn't anything that you could reach that was beyond experience. Everything can be explicated from within this domain. And if there were more to know, then we are not, it's not accessible to us, at least not in this state we're in now. So I must have got somewhere. Are the transcendental subjects human beings? No. After all, the epoche has made them into phenomena so that the philosopher within the epoche has neither himself nor the others, naively and straightforwardly valid as human beings, but as poles for transcendental regressive inquiries. So you're all poles in this world now, showing your various facets to me, and my intention, my meaning intention says, and you are a human being like me. Here each I is considered purely as the ego pole of his acts, habitualities and capacities, and thence as being directed at what appears in ontic certainty through the appearances, the manners of givenness of the latter. i.e. as directed toward the particular object pole and its pole horizon, the world. So he's saying that my understanding of you is that you are like me, that you are the center of your own transcendental subjective experience of the world. That's my understanding of you. Concretely, each I is not merely an ego pole, but an I with its accomplishments and accomplished acquisitions, including the world as existing and being such. But in the epoche and in the pure focus upon the functioning ego pole, it follows that nothing human is to be found. Neither soul, nor psychic life, nor real psychophysical human beings. All this belongs to the phenomenon, the world as constituted pole. You see, he's playing with something here that says, I'm granting you real true being, that's somehow different from my having constituted you. Our sort of understanding of transcendental subjectivity and intersubjectivity is it's a strange area, right? There's a two levels here. Understanding objects is all right because we're not thinking that the objects are looking back at us and that the objects are also the source of intelligibility. But I'm understanding all of you as sources of intelligibility and you're doing it back to me. And that is something that I believe. He wants to look into how is it that I have come to constitute that form of meaning and granted that meaning to you. So we're going back from who are we to who am I, because Husserl's coming to the recognition that in the epoche, as we said at the beginning, there is no you. The only thing that I have is my consciousness. I don't have your consciousness. I don't have it immediately, as immediately present to me. So there's something in this idea of transcendental intersubjectivity where I think that I have your consciousness like I have my consciousness. But I don't, actually. I only actually have my consciousness. I constitute the idea, the meaning that you have consciousness in the same way that I constitute the meaning that this phone is an independent and enduring being. But you're a special kind of being, right? Because my meaning intention invests you with the being like my being. So it's an extraordinary... Do you see what I mean? As a phenomenologist, we're saying this is an extraordinarily complex meaning structure that we've made called another human being.
So has he accepted the paradox and just moved on then? Or is he in the process of dealing with it? Because
we're in the process.
It's like humanization.
He's not actually, in a way, he's not going to resolve the paradox. He's just going to describe how it is that we constitute the being of others. Which, in a way, to jump to the end of the story, you know, the punchline, he's saying we aren't human beings. In the objective sense in the world, finally.
We are not.
That our humanness is a self-objectification of transcendental subjectivity.
Is it one second?
It's a self-objectification. And in a similar way that I objectify myself as a being in the world, I objectify everyone else. But we got to follow him through the story. It's a good story about how we do that. So we're still caught in the paradox. For I am the one who performs the epoche. And even if there are others who practice the epoche in direct community with me, like now, they and all other human beings, the ones who aren't practicing the epoche, with their entire act life, are included for me within my epoche, in the world phenomenon which is exclusively mine. There's only this consciousness for me. The epoche creates a unique sort of philosophical solitude where I am not an ego who still has his you, his we, his total community of co-subjects in natural validity. All of mankind and the whole distinction and ordering of the personal pronouns has become a phenomenon. The I that I attain is actually called I only by equivocation, though it is an essential equivocation, since when I name it in reflection, I can say nothing other than it is I who practice the epoche, I who interrogate as phenomenon the world which is now valid for me according to its being and being such, with all its human beings, of whom I am so fully conscious. It is I who stand above all natural existence that has meaning for me, who am the ego pole of this transcendental life, in which at first the world has meaning for me purely as world. It is I who, taken in full concreteness, encompass all that. Okay, I think this is a terribly important part of the book. He says, and you can almost slip over it, the I that I attain is actually called I only by equivocation. That means he's uncertain whether we can really call this transcendental power, if you like, that is constituting life, whether we can call it I, whether we can identify it with something personal. But he immediately leaps over it and says it's an essential equivocation, since when I name it in reflection, I can say nothing other than, and then he says all the things that you have to say in reflection. But he doesn't pause on this distinction between the immediacy of being conscious now and reflecting on it. Because reflection is necessarily a separation. And in that separation, I suggest, is where I emerges, where the idea of there being an I, or the sense of there being an I, emerges. And this is where Husserl he's equivocating, because if you don't reflect, and of course you can't do any phenomenology, phenomenology occurs in reflection, your our regressive inquiry is all a matter of reflecting on experience. But if you close that down and you stop reflecting, you still have the phenomenon of the world, but there's no I as such. I wonder if you can see that. It's like putting a sock in your mouth. You can't think. If you don't think, there's no I. As soon as you think, I think. Do you see there's a weddedness between the sense of there being an I and having a thought. The I is almost the when you reflect, then you've got your field of experience, if you like, your field of consciousness, that's then over there, and something is looking at it. Who's looking at it? I am. but you've pulled apart what is pre-reflectively unified. And now we get into a very, this is quite a fine place of being able to recognize that that is so. Because you move into another paradox, which is, well, how can I possibly recognize that so unless I reflect on it?
Given that this could be a particular psychological state, there could be another psychological state where you kind of, where it's other, you feel that there's I and there is this man who's thinking. There could be a possible psychological state, maybe, not very common.
Well, I think there's a state of. I think it's a definite state where thinking or reflecting stops, and then you've got the puzzle, which in a way goes beyond herself, as to how you might inquire into that, because it seems. Utter paradox, right? You can't. How could I inquire into a state without separating myself and looking at it? And I have my own answer to that, and I'd like to try it out on you. In previous course, I've written a little piece on this to soften people up, and I give it at the beginning of the course. In this course, I decided not to do it, but you will have read it about direct knowledge of consciousness. I don't know if you remember. So there's. I'm just going to describe this sense that maybe at this moment, and I don't wish to get you, you know, there's a danger of hypnotism going on here. At this moment, if you, just purely listening to what I'm saying, then you're actually not thinking. You're just hearing the words that I'm saying, and at the same time. You know what they mean. I just like you to dwell phenomenologically on the fact that in a stream of words coming out of my mouth like this, you don't have to reflect, you don't have to separate and say, well, what does he mean? You know, the words, it's only if you don't understand what I'm saying that you might stop and reflect and say, well, what does he mean? But if at a certain level, language, we just understand it. It's almost a miracle. Because in a way, I think we all have a model. Where, oh, no, you know, there's a little man in there that's working out what the words mean. Well, there's no little man in there working out what the words mean. I just speak them, you just hear them.
Unless you're foreign language.
Yeah. Unless, yeah.
How about little men?
No, but your little... How is your little man going at the moment?
It's almost here.
Would I have to speak to you in Estonian?
Russian. Yeah.
You can't, the little man, right now, surely.
My little man is always here.
Your little man's always there. That you'll have to go and study phenomenology in Estonian. Or in Russia. We have to go.
Well,
no, you don't. Because you can go. You can do this just by speaking Russian with someone.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying because yes. You know, I experience it when I speak my native language.
Yes.
But in the case of English language, I guess if my little man rests, I'm just going to be removed from.
So that's interesting because I thought after a while. That would go.
Well, depends how you practice English.
Yes.
I had a flatmate and he's Italian. I always try and tell him that don't translate to Italian, try to understand English. Like, try to think of the English word and not to the equivalent Italian word.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's essential to kind of understand English, you know? Understand human culture and how things feel.
Yes.
That too, but what I'm saying that the process of translation has to start. Not in translation, but to tuning in has to start so the little man does this tuning in.
But, But you know, I don't speak French, but I don't translate bonjour. You know, there are.
We're not on an entry level.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. we're a bit past. Yeah, comment allez-vous? Yes. 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 Do a baguette, s'il vous plaît. You think we've gone past there? Oh.
I think you could. Sorry.
Yes.
There's a certain amount. I lived in France for a few years, and that translation thing, you possibly can get over it with time, as I'm trying to mention, but I think it is always there, because also in terms of the society, the culture, you may feel yourself to be a bit of an outsider, as was discussed as the little man, I think is always there in a strange way.
Yeah, I mean, you're making me think, as we're talking about this, about my next course, you know, where it's pretty much recognised that a language is a world. And so, in a way, you're saying that the little man's there means that... in a sense, you're still. It's not just the language. It's the world that you inhabit.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You're trying to make sense of the language based on your own
experience.
Yeah.
Yes. So it's not just a word for word thing.
No.
It's like there's each language. There's an understanding of the world
and
in
the
it.
Meaning, yeah.
And as insofar as you still live in that understanding. If you were to stop translating, that would signify in a way that you'd become English, a terrible fate. Just imagine. Well, you see what it's like from the outside. It's
I think though that there are certain languages which are easier to pick up. Is it Icelandic, which is very pictorial? I'm just wondering, for me. Having lived in France, part of the difficulty was actually in terms of the construction, in terms of English. The grammar that I learned at school was pretty minimal, but you're having to learn new concepts, and you're doing that in a foreign land, which has also got its differentness, and at the same time you've still got to stay very much your own identity whilst you've got that little man go on, whilst you're trying to be as social as possible to integrate yourself. It's quite a challenge. Is that a lived experience
that
others?
I imagine.
I've never really dealt with trying to live in a land with another language. You know, Australia and America don't count. Even then, people are living in a slightly different world. I get the idea of
yeah.
And I'm more or less assimilated Australia, but I couldn't in the US. You know, that was too.
Were brought up as a child, if you spent time, because I spent time in France when I was quite young, and although I don't speak the language, I feel quite at home there.
Yeah.
When I go back, I feel quite at home because of something in my childhood got in me, living with my cousins and being there.
Is that like Proust and there's the Madeleine that takes him all the way back to his childhood there?
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
I think there's
something about that, whereas it might not be, but I don't spend time in France now much, but occasionally.
But I'm going to pull us back because the phenomenon I was wanting to indicate was that you can that we understand language without thinking, which is it's worth pausing on, because it seems like language and thought are the same thing. And in a way, it's almost, I mean, it's a little bit like I'm doing your thinking for you. You know, when somebody else is speaking and you go absolutely still, it's almost like we're all having the same thought, in a way. But there's something, if you start to just look at the phenomenon of hearing and understanding language, you stay present. You're not taken off, if you like. there's a certain way of speaking like I'm doing now where I'm not taking you off down some alleyway. The speech is keeping you here. I'm saying, we're just listening to speech and the way that meaning is occurring. It's quite marvellous. I'm saying this because it's possible to interrogate this place where you haven't separated with a question. And I think this is where we move toward Heidegger, away from Husserl and toward Heidegger. It's possible to actually hold a question. The question could be, am I thinking? And for me, I can ask that question and I can just let it fall. Am I thinking? And I find I'm not. And I find I know I'm not. And I'm not reflecting. I'm not thinking, am I thinking? I just present the question, am I thinking? And I just let it fall. Now, if you can do that, and it's not really a doing, it's an actually not doing, you can see that it's possible to just place a question like a phone. You can just place a question in your field of immediate consciousness. You don't have to think about it. You basically inquire of the field, is it yes or is it no? Which in effect, if it's a question of experience, the question that you ask is saying, is experience like this? See, when I say, am I thinking, I'm really saying, is experience of the form that I'm not thinking? That's really what the question is asking. And as you fall into it, experience itself just, it has that capacity to agree or disagree with the question. It doesn't comment or anything. It just agrees or disagrees. And in a way, in there, in that state of not thinking, there's the capacity to understand language and the capacity to answer without thinking, without separating, without reflecting. Because the thing that I missed at the beginning of the course that I'm giving to you now is the question, which is at the sort of heart of things here, is what is it to be conscious? And this is a question that exercises analytic philosophers very, very deeply. The answer to what is it to be conscious is to just ask the question and look. Because obviously, although I've had trouble with this in the past, talking to people, obviously there is consciousness. I mean, the language starts to fail here, right? If I say I am conscious, I'm already in the... I'm asking this question and I'm throwing it into the field of the being of consciousness. And I'm asking consciousness, do you know what it is to be conscious? Do you know what consciousness is, consciousness? Do you see, that's the question. I say, consciousness, do you know what it is to be conscious? And consciousness, for me, says... It doesn't say anything, it knows. But to be conscious is to know what it is to be conscious. That's what consciousness is. And I'd just like you, if you can, to see that in the knowing what it is to be conscious, not even language can touch it. You know, there's the very few things that language The Amish can mostly get to things, but when it comes to what is it to be, if you start to try and explain it, you know that that's stupid. Do you know, if you've got to try and tell someone what it is to be conscious, it's stupid. There's a stupidity in it, because it's the very ground or means by which anything is known. So you can't know it like a thing. Do you see? If you were trying to know what consciousness is like a thing, you'd be using consciousness to do it, and you'd be reflecting, and you're lost. But if you can just come down and say, just look at it, consciousness is absolutely conscious. What is it to be conscious? Well, it's just a matter of being conscious. And in being conscious, you know what it is to be conscious. And if you know it deeply enough, you understand that you can't tell anybody. You don't need to tell anyone. Insofar as the person that you're with is conscious and they're able to fall back into this, that's it. That's the true communion of intersubjectivity. But I go past. That's all to do with that one sentence, right? With I, the equivocation. As soon as I reflect, then I in a way I make an I out of that consciousness. And you can't really do that. Do you see? As soon as you've made an I and you've started to reflect, you've left the immediacy of consciousness now.
Does consciousness mean proposition of?
Well, our language is such that we can't speak of it, because our language is a separating out of. Even, you know. Say, what did you want?
If you say consciousness or conscious, do you mean to put an of there?
Well, there's a...
For it to happen, to be conscious. For example, can I say, if I want to say I'm conscious, should I say I'm conscious of this thought, I'm conscious of my tongue moving, I'm conscious of this visual...
So the best that I've done with this, which is on a basis of reflection, is something like this. Consciousness is always conscious of something or other. Something or other is always being presented, if you like, in consciousness. It might be what I'm saying. It might be that you're looking at the phone. But there's always consciousness of, which sort of implies that there's a separation there. But there's the entire field of the consciousness of, which has a structure to it of intentionality, which is what the cells speaking of, that my consciousness of the phone has this directionality, so it appears that there's something coming from somewhere going towards something, is entirely encompassed in a sheer consciousness that presents what I'm conscious of. I wonder if you can see that. There's a structure of intentionality that is showing everything, that is the structure of the meaning, but that is always surrounded by something that is not conscious of, it's just conscious. It's conscious. I mean, you get an infinite regress, but you say it's conscious of what I'm conscious of, but it's not. Do you see, if you had that, it would never end. You finally fall back on something that is just a sheer mirror, if you like. It's not really a mirror, but that's maybe the best word that you can have of it. It just presents. What does it present? It presents the sheer meaning of whatever it is that you're experiencing. It's not conscious of it. It's presenting It's a sheer presenting. But then when you look into it, you see that there is a consciousness of the things that you're looking at within that. So there's like two levels. When I was trying to write about it, like there's two moments of consciousness. There's what you're conscious of, and then there's the sheer being conscious that's always ever present. Even if you got lost, even if you've forgotten you're conscious, there's still the consciousness that presents what is presenting you being lost. It's presenting you having forgotten you're conscious. It never goes away, if you see what I mean. You could say it goes away when you go to sleep, but then as far as we're concerned, when it goes away, there's nothing. So, going back, because this is a very important point for Husserl, I get the sense, but again, there's an awful lot of his writing that is the way where, and a lot of what Fink had to say, that questions this. But at this point in what he's saying, I get the sense that he thinks that the eye of his reflecting eye somehow is transcendental subjectivity. I don't think so.
I'm not clear that last sentence. What he's saying is his, say it again, you said his eye.
When he goes into reflection, the sense that I get from his writing, this is where we're in, we're trying to deal with what he meant. Mm-hmm. And so it's not, we're not dealing with experience itself, we're dealing with what did Husserl mean. So it's always going to be difficult without him being present, and we can't have that. The sense is that he has the sense that transcendental subjectivity is reflecting on itself. I guess I've got an argument that I don't know if you'll find it convincing or not, but this kind of... My thinking goes along these lines. If you could identify something directly with a process that's occurring in your brain, then it's in the world. It's not part of the transcendence. And my reflecting, my thinking, can be traced back to an event happening in my brain. And for me, I call if we're looking at, there's a kind of a division here, you know, what lies on the side of transcendental subjectivity and what lies on the side of the world that we project. Yes, what's part of the constituted world? And my best way I can describe this is all of the reflecting that we do when we're engaging in phenomenology, you need a brain to do it, right? You need neurons. Something's firing in your head. There's a certain intentionality in you to inquire back into experience. It's all happening, and there's a physical correlate to it happening. There's no physical correlate to being conscious. See, let me put it another way. We're at the finest end I think we can get in this course. There's all of this stuff happening in your brain. What is transcendental subjectivity doing if we think of things in those terms? It's making it meaningful. Right? So all of the things happening in your brain, they're just neurons firing, if you like. You know, there's some kind of ionic, chemical, electrical transfer of energy between neurons, and they're firing away. And those firing of those neurons explain my hands moving, they explain my tongue going up and down, they explain everything else. Margaritas, you know, the neurons are moving their hands, you know, the whole thing is explicable at that level. What's not explicable is that it means anything. That actually all of that stuff, it becomes a world. And it does, it becomes a world. It, to such an extent that when you get in the epoche, you say, well, there probably isn't a brain anyway. That's just something that appears on this side. Yes, we project the being of everything physical, including the brain. But consciousness itself, the transcendental itself, its action is to transform what goes on into this experience of meaning. So it does nothing physical. Do you see? There's utterly nothing physical in it. It just takes what we consider to be the physical and transforms it into this... sometimes when I think about this, if we separate things out, we say consciousness here, physical world there, which isn't true, right? It's just a model. And then you say, what's consciousness do? It's like it has to go... It reads the brain. The brain for it is like a book. It says... What does all this mean? I know what it means. It means you're in a body on earth with all these other people sitting around. Do you see what a task it would be if I gave it to you? Say, well, what does that mean? Just a bunch of twitching cells. Yeah? How does that become this? Do you see what transcendental subjectivity reads that? It knows what it means. Knows what it means? Is it Gollum? No. Never mind about that. I mean, my picture of transcendental subjectivity is it's somehow the memory of all of life on Earth and what it's meant. You know, why does pain hurt so much? Do you know, in pain almost has the memory of every animal that's ever been injured in it. It's a kind of a distilled essence of what it is to be alive on earth. And do you see, it doesn't do anything. I don't know how to put it this way. It doesn't act. It's too fast for that. It simply makes meaning. Whereas when I, as a phenomenologist, decide to reflect on how experience is constituted, it's happening on the other side. As soon as I reflect, I become worldly again. It's not transcendental subjectivity reflecting. It's me, John.
Conditioning.
Yeah. And I have to use my brain and all of its past, and I can only do the reflecting because I read Husserl in the past. You know, because of all my studying, it all depends on me. The worldly me is doing the reflecting, is doing the philosophizing, not transcendental subjectivity. Transcendental subjectivity is constituting the meaning of what I'm thinking, but it's not doing the thinking.
And have you noticed that pain itself, the experience of pain itself, it's not as bad as thinking about it? It's completely something else when you, the pure sense of the pure.
I'd say that it's different. I'm not sure yeah. Which is what.
You definitely
haven't
given birth.
Yes.
What? You definitely haven't given birth.
Okay. Yeah. It's not. They're different. There's a different kind of suffering in thinking about.
That's the fish.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a different kind of suffering in. A mental suffering is different. It's different. There's something cleaner in physical pain, but you know, there's only so much you can bear, isn't it? I mean, there's a point where I would say, now give me the mental suffering. Now, I was trying to take us to quite a refined place there. of trying to, because this is where I feel like Husserl and Heidegger, I was saying it last time, where they, in a way, they part company, and Heidegger had the deeper insight into the into this sense that you can only go so far in this essentially rationally structured form of reflection. You know, because there was a split happened with Husserl and Heidegger, where Husserl regarded Heidegger as moving off into the irrational, that he left rationality behind in a way, which in a sense was his, he left behind the idea or the ideal that that human intelligence in the epoche, by reflecting on experience, could come to answer all meaningful questions. And Heidegger, at his best, because I'm not sure, you know, Heidegger at his best just said something like this: I'm just going to ask the question and listen. I'm going to await what he called being. I'm going to wait on being. But I hesitate, you see, I hesitate, because if you read, there's a book by an American philosopher called Brezina that goes into much more detail about how Finck and Husserl work together, and they reached their own much finer understanding of what transcendental subjectivity is than is expressed here. So it's not as if this is the final word from Husserl. It's more like he's left things a little unclear there about what it is to reflect, what is transcendental life, what is transcendental subjectivity. All right, I've still got a good section for the second part about how we actually constitute the other. I think that's the next one. Yeah, but should we have a break first?